Question number 30,001, Mr. Peter Erst, Real 29. Now, you're talking about that when you were acting as escort, there's some Soviet bloc generals, and Prince Michael of Kent, who was a major at the time, who was with. Anything else about that?
Yes, there was one interesting thing. We stayed at a hotel for about 4 or 5 days, all of us, in Prince Michael and myself and all these foreign officers, in a place just north of Salisbury.
Amersfoort.
What name?
Amersfoort. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. I don't think it's relevant to the story.
No. Anyway, we stayed at a hotel there, and I was talking, after being there a couple of nights, because having been at with the Joint Warfare Establishment at Salisbury, you know, I knew that area pretty well. And I said to Prince Michael, there's a very good pub just south of Salisbury, and it wouldn't be a bad idea, perhaps, if we took these chaps down there, give them a change and a break. He said, yes, good idea. And the people that ran this pub, there was a French lady and her English husband. When I was with my wife, and I used to go there a lot, got to know them very well, and the food was always magnificent. A very nice place. So I gave her a ring. And I said, oh, this is Peter. Oh, how are you? I said, well, I'm fairly close by you at the moment with some officers from some other nations. And I've got Prince Michael Kent with me. We all come. Oh, she said, go on, tell me another one. So I said, all right, well, we'll see you later. She thought I was pulling her leg. So we walked in there, and lo and behold, Prince Michael and Kent walked, and I walked in together. I could see her eyes popping up. She thought, my God, he wasn't kidding me. And so we had a good meal there, which they enjoyed. And then...
did you get on well with it? How did you get on with these Soviet bloc generals and Nigerian generals?
Yeah, it was fine, yes. We all got on very well.
Do you think it broke down the barriers in any way?
Well, within our small group, yes. Yes, I mean...
But nothing serious?
No, not internationally.
Anything else about that posting with 5 Airport War Brigade, as it was?
Well, Dwyn Bramall, the brigadier, as I say, he and I, and Betty, my wife, and his wife, we used to get on very well together. We used to invite him over to our house for dinner, and we used to have a bit of a party. And likewise, he used to invite us over to his place. And I was a member on one occasion. Sometimes he would have a more formal dinner in black tie and have about 8 people there. And he and his wife used to sit at one end of this long table, and he used to take a shine to my wife, and he said, Betty, he said, I want you to sit on my right hand side. She said, all right, Dwyn. Well, she's called, his name was Edward, but you always know as Dwyn. And said, I was on the other side of the table somewhere, and on next to Betty on her right hand side was a colonel, full colonel, doctor. And they were talking and how to do, and this doctor led across to Brigadier, said, did you know Brigadier? He said, 2 weeks ago I was in Gibraltar, and I came back by an RAF transport aircraft, and the crew was drunk. And Betty looked at him and she said, what did you say? The crew was drunk? Yes. She said, I do not believe it. And then Jim Bramall said, by the way, this lady is the wife of my wing commander, who's a very experienced air operator. Oh, he said. And she said to him, she said, I don't believe that. She said, the RAF air crews love a good party. No doubt about that, but there was no way in which they would fly an aircraft for no drunk. No way. And so old Brigadier Dwyn Bramall put his hand on her forearm and said, wonderful, my dear. Not support. What? Oh, I don't know. My memory these days is dreadful.
Okay. What? So
what support? What's something like that?
I know what you mean. I think yeah. we get the idea.
Yeah.
Now, so what's your next posting after that? Because you were there another 2 years, were you? I presume.
I was with the army for nearly 3 years, I think.
From August 68 to.
From August 68 to October 71.
Now, what was your next posting? Because this would be your last posting, I think.
Yeah, the next one was to RAF Wattisham in Suffolk.
And what were you there?
I was the officer commanding the administrative wing. And I was also deputy station commander.
Now, how did you enjoy that role?
Well, it was very enjoyable. I had a very nice house there, as always. We always had some good houses. And I was only there for about 18 months. And I left the service. But during that period, we had some very enjoyable times. We had a good social life.
Well, let's start with, what were your duties in the two roles? You were an administrative officer.
Well, I covered the whole of the administration of the station. And I wasn't involved in running the flying. There was the flying wing and the administrative wing. And I was in charge of the administrative wing, covering everything connected with running the station.
Did you enjoy it? Did you find that dull? Because you've always been connected with flying.
Yes. Well, I used to get quite a bit of flying in doing this. They had lightnings, two lightning squadrons there. And I did some flying in the lightnings.
I will come to that, but I mean, did you find administration boring? I mean, even there your mind flicked to flying. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, yes. No, I had quite an interesting job there. And of course, if Ken Goodwin was the station commander, and if he was away, I used to stand in for him. My office was next door to his, so it was useful.
Yeah, all right, tell me about these flights and lightning. Were you actually allowed to, you actually got to fly them as well, though? I mean, not just sit in one. I mean,
they were the two-seater lightnings. And, yes, I always went with the qualified squadron pilot. And,
now, what did you think of the lightning to fly? Because that's the next generation on.
Yes. It was very good. You know, used to tremendous power there.
More than what you'd had.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Again, because
you'd
said how powerful the Venom was.
This Yes. It had two Rolls-Royce Avon engines, one on top of the other, and it had a lot of power there. The biggest snag with the lightning, of course, is it didn't carry sufficient fuel to enable it to be airborne for a very long time. But I did very fast climbs up to 40,000 feet, and then I went up to Mark 2 two or three times. So I went through the sound barrier and then to double the speed of sound at Mark 2.
Did you enjoy that still?
Yes, yeah, I enjoyed it. And I flew it most of the time.
So the experienced pilot would let you get on with it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they could see I knew roughly what to do.
Was it difficult to fly compared to anything else you'd flown, or was it just more of the same?
No, it was a similar style, but I unfortunately wasn't able to have enough flying hours to really get totally to grips with it, but nevertheless, it was very good. I enjoyed it.
Now, how did you get on? The station commander was John Mellors. How did you get on with him?
I used to get on very well with him, but he was posted because there was an aircraft crash and they had to close the runways, one thing and another, and the command decided to move him on, and they brought in another chap named by the name of Ken Goodwin. And I knew Ken Goodwin from when we used to go to Sylt. He was one of the pilot attack instructors who was posted to, he always used to, when he knew 5 Squadron was going up there, he always used to say to his people, if 5 Squadron's coming up, I want to go with them. And I got to know Ken very well in Germany. And then, of course, came back here and came across him again. So it was a good thing. And I've remained friends with Ken ever since.
Now, so you got on well with both station commanders?
Oh, yes.
Now, what about this accident? What exactly happened? Because, or are you aware of what happened?
Well, not totally. I know that one chap was taking off and he lifted his undercarriage too soon and then scraped along the runway and the aircraft caught fire. And, of course, terrific damage to the runway. And we only had one runway there, so there was no alternative. And they had to close the airfield and move the other squadron chaps over to another airfield while ours was being repaired, and it took about.
Now, the next thing I want to go on is you became a quick reaction alert force in the 70s.
Yes.
At Waddesham. You weren't.
No.
But the station was.
Yes, yes.
The lightnings on it. What did this mean?
Well, they had 2 lightnings standing by to go off at a moment's notice, because sometimes the Russian aircraft were trying to take a quick peep at what we were up to over here. And so the lightning could get up there pretty quickly and shoo them off.
So this is very similar to what you'd started doing in your early career.
Yes.
Now, anything else about your time at Waddesham?
Not really, I don't think, no.
Were you aware it was your last posting?
Well, no, not at the time I went there, because you retired at the age of 55, and that's the normal retiring age. Well, in the 1973, my brother-in-law, who was a chartered surveyor, head of the biggest charter surveying company in this country, said, if you could get out of the Air Force, would you like to come and join us? And opened up some new offices in us, because I know that in some of your NATO staff appointments, you had an involvement with some of the countries that we're looking at to see if we could expand. So he said, I said, well, I don't know whether they'd let me out or not. I'm sure. I don't see why they shouldn't, because with only about 15 months, 18 months to go, there's no further hope of any promotion. Not with that short time in hand. So I applied.
You were a wing commander at the time.
Yes.
I forgot to mention when you got from.
Yes.
You've been promoted to that.
Oh, I'd been a wing commander a long time.
Yeah.
Yes. So I applied to leave, and they wouldn't let me go. So, I told my brother, I said, well, I can write in a letter. He said, well, you do that, and I'll write a letter as well, which he did. He wrote to the Air Ministry. And eventually they let me go. And so when was it? 1973.
Well, you had a last flight on the 26th of April, 73, and your book makes quite a big thing, or Hugh Thomas's book made quite. Do you remember your last flight? Was it any way special? It's in a lightning, I presume. Yes, it was.
Oh, yes. April the 26th. I was with Ken Goodwin.
Do you remember it at all?
Yes. Yes, I do. Because I knew Ken very well, you see. And he wrote a little note here. A precisely flown sortie with smooth aerobatics. Lack of practice has in no way diminished or hidden this officer's natural skill as a fighter pilot. And the flight makes a fitting conclusion to a long and distinguished career as a military pilot. Good luck And Godspeed wherever you go, Pete. Sincerely, Ken Goodwin.
Well, that's a nice thing for him to write. I mean, you must have appreciated it. Yeah. How did you feel? Were you sad to realise that that was it?
Well, yes, in some ways. But on the other hand, I knew that I had not long to go anyway. And with the opportunity to get organised in a reasonably good position, I thought it was worth taking because, as I say, there was no further hope of any promotion. I mean, if there had been, I wouldn't have stayed.
Were you sad to leave, though?
Yes, after such a long period of service with the RAF, it was quite a thing to leave. But and then I went in.
Now we don't really cover your post service career in much detail because obviously as a war museum we don't. But we do like to see whether you get safely into civilian life. So can you sort of summarise your business career? Because I mean, you worked till you were 80, so you could another 25 years.
Well, I did a variety of things.
Just sort of summarise it very briefly, if you don't mind.
Yes. Well, I joined my brother-in-law's firm of chartered surveyors called Jones Lang Wooden, and they had two offices in Europe at that time, one in Paris and one in Brussels, and they wanted to expand in other countries, and mainly Germany and Holland, where I'd had involvements in various ways. And so my London office was in Mount Street. I had a very nice office there, where that was their West End office, and they had offices all over this country, and they had two in Europe, one in Paris and one in Brussels. And when I joined them, I used to travel about twice a week out to Europe, fly out from Heathrow then. And I went to Paris, got to know the people there in the existing office. I went to Brussels and did the same there. And they usually had a British surveyor in charge of each office. But then they wanted to open in Holland. And I went to Rotterdam and Amsterdam and set up companies. In this country, chartered surveyors are not companies, they're partnerships. Whereas in the continent, they don't have partnerships. Everything has to be done under a company basis. So I had to set up companies in accordance with the company law of the country concerned. And by that, it was dealing with the bankers, the lawyers and the accountants, and finding office accommodation. And I was doing that. And I did that in Germany as well, in Frankfurt, Düsseldorf and Hamburg. And then we opened up another office in Belgium to support Brussels at Antwerp. And we were going to open another office in France to support Paris at Marseille. But that didn't go ahead because at that time there was quite a big property crunch in the UK. On commercial properties, that is, office blocks and so on. And they said, my brother-in-law said to me, we're going to sit tight for a bit, no further expansion for the time being. So I was hanging around. I used to continue to go out to the offices which I'd already set up and make sure they were running smoothly. And they used to put a British surveyor in charge of each these offices abroad, so I was able to deal with him and make sure that they were carrying out everything in accordance with the laws of the country concerned, and that I continued to do until this hold-up came. And after a bit, several months, I was fed up with not being really fully occupied, and I told my brother-in-law, and I said, you know, I don't like sitting around only half doing a job. So he said, well, we hope that it'll pull out soon, but we don't know when. Well, during the time I'd been with them, I got to know one or two big property developers, and one in particular, a chap named Ronald Lyon, and he had he built a block of superior luxury flats in Park Lane. That was their front, and on the rear area they backed onto Park Street, which runs parallel with Park Lane. And he asked me if I would go and see him. I went and saw him. He had, within his huge flat, he had one room as an office. And he said, I'm very anxious to do some development in Iran. And he said, I know you've got some good contacts out there, because my daughter married an Iranian prince. And he said, you know, perhaps you could go and have a look for me, see what the scene is. So I said, yes, all right. And I used to fly out first class with him and stay in the best hotels. I went out to Tehran. I stayed for about a month. And I was looking around all sorts of possible development sites where he could go out there. And by this, at this time, by the way, the Shah was still in power. And I had some very good contacts out there. My daughter's father-in-law was His Excellency Ag Khan Bakhtiar, and he was the head of the National Iranian Oil Company, in addition to being director of the Agricultural Development Bank and one or two other organizations. So I went and saw him on arrival. And he's on the top floor of this 20-story building in the main business street in Tehran. And I said, oh, hello, Peter. How nice to see you again. How long are you staying? I said, 3 or 4 weeks, I should think. How are you going to be getting around then while you're here? So I said, I shall walk or I shall take a taxi. Oh, no, no, he said, don't. Have my car and my driver. Had a bloody great 450 Merc. I was driven around wherever I wanted to go. It was marvellous. Anyway, I had to look at a lot of these possible sites for development. Some of them were old buildings due to be pulled down, and others were just plots of land. And the prices that the Iranians were asking for these were quite ridiculous. I mean, totally out of this world. So I looked at an awful lot, and I came up with the same sort of information each time. Now, when I got back to Ron Ilan, I told him, I said, look, they're asking ridiculous prices. They're quite out of this world. They're just taking advantage, or trying to take advantage of a situation where they think they can win hands down. So he said, well, all right, well, thanks for that. He said, what about in 2 or 3 months' time, 3 or 4 months, whatever, go and have another look for me, see if things change. So I said, yes, okay. So I did just that. And I went and saw some more people. And by that time, by the time I got back, by the way, things hadn't changed. And I'd said, Ronnie, don't put any money into Iran. You'd be throwing it away. He says, all right, well, I'll take your advice. But during the time I've been going out there, and I've been going out for fairly long periods, I got to know a lot of Iranians in various forms. And a number of people in this country got to know that I was going out there. And there was a firm in Croydon, a firm of engineering consultants. And they were wanting to build railways out there. And so I went out there and on their behalf, and got them a very good contract. They built the railway going out of Tehran towards the west. And then I got involved in agriculture. And that's quite a story. I don't know how...
We haven't got much time. I think that gives us the idea. You're using your contacts in Iran
yes.
to build up business,
yes.
Opportunities for various firms.
Yes, and then...
How long have you been doing that for?
About 2 years.
And then what?
Then, of course, the Shah left the country. They had the revolution started. And I was there at the time it started. November 1979.
What do you remember of that? Because that is relevant.
Well, they had all the streets were manned by troops, and they had tanks on street corners, and it was quite a thing. But I got out all right, no problems.
Was there much violence directed at foreigners, or?
No. No, they were just trying to get rid of the Shah, which they did.
Did you have any sympathy for them at all, or
well, of course, yes, because the Shah's second wife, Saroya, was a Bakhtiar, and was my ex-son-in-law's cousin, and a niece of His Excellency. And, was quite a person, but unfortunately they couldn't have any children, and therefore they decided to split, and he remarried, and then it did eventually produce some children.
So what happens next then, after the revolution? What do you decide to do then?
Oh, well, I came back to this country, and then I got involved. I was still working more or less in conjunction with Ronnie Lyon, and he, by this time, opened an office in Dubai, and was run by an old school friend of mine, who was also a director of Ronnie's firm. And he asked me if I'd go out and have a look round. They wanted to develop out there, so I went out to Dubai. I was only there for a week, and had a look at the scene. And I helped them a bit. And
what was your next big step? You move into an entirely different field, don't you?
Well, yes. A friend of mine was the chief environmental health officer for British Airways. And he said, "Is that the Hoover?" He said, "I'm due to retire shortly. Would you like to join me if I set up? Because I think there's something in this asbestos business that I've been in, because I'm the only one in the airlines who knows anything about it." And they said, "There's quite a lot of it in the airlines building." So I said, "Well, I'll come with you." He said, "I know you've got some good contacts." But he said, "I know about the asbestos side, but not, I don't have the contacts." So I said, "All right, well, but only on a consultancy basis." And I joined him. And I was getting him a lot of business, and he had to take on more people. And then he said, "Well, things are going pretty well, you know." So I said, "Yeah, good." I said, "I feel that I ought to learn something more about it." And so I went on site with him and put overalls on, and he taught me microscopy. And by that time, I felt much more confident about what I was trying to flog. And then I went out. It was a bit easier for me because I could talk from a little bit of experience.
Would this just be detecting asbestos or clearing it after you detected it?
No, just detecting it. No, they had asbestos removal contractors to clear it.
And that became a family business.
Eventually, but you see, Harry died, and then I thought, goodness, there is something in this. I think there's some business. So I went off on two concentrated courses, one at the Institute of Occupational Medicine in Edinburgh, and another one at Bristol University, and these were sort of month courses. And by that time, I felt much happier and confident about setting up. So I bought a microscope and I set up on my own as a sole trader. And for no time at all, I was getting far more work than I could cope with. So I took on another chap and I trained him. And then I took on another chap and I trained him. So, business was good, really. And it developed and grew and grew. And I had about 15 people on staff in the end. I thought, after a couple of years, I can't be a sole trader any longer. And I set up a company and became corporate.
And that's still going, but you handed it to your grandson.
I handed that to my grandson. It was Erst Analysis Limited, but we changed the name. He's changed the name to Erst Environmental Limited, which is more all-embracing.